Let me begin by first thanking you all for being here at this time of the day. This being the last day of lectureship, the last session before we dismiss to go to supper, it is a very difficult time to not only be the speaker, but to be the listener. But I understand last year this was the spot that I was given. And I said at that time that I understood, you know, you can take it two different ways. Either you're asked to speak this position at this place because of the fact that nobody cares who speaks at this time anyway, or you're the only one who can bring enough people in here to make a difference at that hour. Now, I can decide whichever I want, and I've counted, and there's three more this year than there were last year at this time, so it's working. This is my spot. It's helping. I'm experiencing a little bit of throat problems, and I apologize for any inconvenience it might be to you in trying to listen to me. I got to go to the doctor and see what's going on. I've seen him once, and he told me I had a couple of spots and told me to take some medicine. I went back, and he said they had gone away and that my boy should heal. But it's been 8 months, and I haven't seen much improvement, so I got to go back. Bookstores are closing up, some of them. I'm going to be closing up my bookstore here later today, so there's only about 8 or 9 more of my books out there. My wife's called Decorum and Discipline. It's a little book we put together that helps you to help those who have not known how, do not know how to raise their kids, are not doing a good job raising their kids. You always want to tell them, look, you're doing it wrong. Now all you got to do is say, read the book. Just a book of little proverbs there. I always enjoy the opportunity to come together to the lectureships. You always see people that you don't normally get to be with. I appreciate the elders here and Don, the invitation to be here and being able to see those of you that may not have seen since last year, and just activities such as this that bring us together. Reminds me of the story I heard about a state trooper in Tennessee who pulled a man over, elderly couple, and as the old man was getting out of his car, the state trooper immediately said, sir, you haven't done anything wrong. I don't want you to be upset. You know, I just want to talk to you. And his wife was in the car, and she said, what'd he say? He said, he just said he wants to talk to me. He said, I noticed that your tags are Tennessee tags, or Virginia tags. Said, I used to live in Virginia when I was a boy, you know, and just right outside of Richmond. And the woman said, what'd he say? Said he used to live in Richmond, just like us. Oh. He says, oh, yeah, you live in Richmond without, what a coincidence. Well, you know, I lived in this community there, you know, we had a neighbor next door. Meanest old couple, or the woman anyway, she was the meanest old woman. Every time our ball went in her yard, we were afraid to go in her yard, and she would scream and holler, and she would keep our toys, and when her husband would try to intervene, she'd scream and holler at him, and the old woman said, what'd he say? He said he thinks he knows you. Sometimes we think we know each other. Sometimes you go to a lectureship, you see somebody, you say, brother, yeah, sister, you know, but we do enjoy being with each other. What is your life? Some words are not as easily defined as others, especially in the English language. Words that you sometimes can have different meanings. Like the other day, I thought that when I was leaving the mall, I thought, well, I better run in here and get a sweater. I'm wearing a thin T-shirt, and I just heard those kids say something about being cool. Well, you see, the words that you hear, the way they're used, has something to do with what they mean. And the words such as life and death also can have different meanings based upon how they're used. And especially when we're talking about God's Word, we need to understand what's being discussed. Are we talking about physical life or spiritual life? Physical death or spiritual death? Well, today, in the question that's asked, the book of James, it says, what is your life? He is talking about how we live our physical life so as to what kind of impact it will have on our spiritual life. But in talking about the physical, understanding death, I want to point this out because of what the world has done with the definition of death. James tells us in James 2 and verse 26, the body without the spirit is dead. So, that being the case, we should know that life is the state or condition of existence that results from the spirit dwelling in the body. And death occurs when the spirit leaves the body. Have you ever heard the stories about the people who said, you know, they were dead, but they were brought back alive? I mean, that person was under the water for half an hour, and nobody can live for half an hour under the water. They weren't breathing. They were brought out of there, and then they were alive. They were brought back to life. You know, they put those people, there was no brain waves. There was just nothing going on in that operating room. They pronounced them dead. Matter of fact, I know a man that was pronounced dead. A man by the name of Don McWhorter, who's a gospel preacher in Alabama. I worked with him for a while. He had a heart condition, has a heart condition, and he was in the emergency room having heart failure. And the doctor that was working on him did all he thought he could and looked at the clock, and he pronounced him dead at a particular time. And they were pulling a sheet over his head, and his regular doctor came in and immediately called for some other medicine. And the doctor that had been working on him said, why do you want to pump perfectly good medicine into a dead body? Which her reply was, no, doctor, the question is, why not? And she immediately put the medicine into his heart, and the heart began to pump, and he was brought back to the living, the state of the living. And he later said, I heard what was going on there. And the doctor that had been working on him said, well, you couldn't have heard anything. What did you hear? He said, well, I heard you say do this and that and give it this kind of medicine. And when that didn't work, I heard you tell them the time in which I was dead, pronounce me dead. I heard my doctor come in and she say, I need to put this medicine. And you say, why? And about that time, that doctor's face, all the color drained out of his face. You see, according to medical science, according to this man, with all his education, he was dead. His body was dead. And yet, he's up walking and breathing and preaching today. What took place? Was it a miracle? No, brethren. The body is alive so long as it has the spirit in it. Medical science may say they have to be dead because we have no pulse. We have no breathing. We have no brainwave activity. This person is dead. The Bible tells us a person's not dead until the spirit leaves. In Genesis chapter 25, verse 8, and talking about Abraham's death, we read, then Abraham gave up the ghost and died. Now, when did he die? When his spirit left his body. In 1 Kings chapter 17, we read about a woman who's a widow woman who has a son, and the prophet Elijah is staying there with her, and the son dies. And so she is crying. And Elijah takes the son, and he prays on behalf of the son. In verse 22, we read, then the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came back to him, and he was revived. Now, he was dead, but how was it that he lived once again? The Bible tells us because the soul came back. The spirit came back into the body. In Genesis chapter 35 and verse 18, and talking about Rachel's death, we read, and so it was as her soul was departing, for she died. And when did she die? When her soul left her body. We read about Stephen's death in Acts chapter 7. And beginning in verse 59, we read, and they stoned Stephen as he was calling on God and saying, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. Then he knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, Lord, do not charge them with this sin. And when he had said this, he fell asleep, or he died. Now, why is it that he died? Because his spirit left his body. So you see, when somebody says it was a miracle, they were dead, but now they're alive. No, brethren, they never were dead. Medical science may say they're dead, but God tells us a person is not dead until the spirit leaves the body. Because Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27 says it's appointed to man once to die. And after that, the judgment. And so we need to understand God's definition of death, God's definition of life. So we look at the question, what is your life? Or what are you doing with the life that you've been given to live in this body so that for the impact that it will have to your final destination of heaven or hell? In James chapter 4, the text which we find this question, again in verse 13 we read, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that." Now, what's the setting here? Why is James having this to say to the brethren? He's scolding them. He's telling them, shame on you. You look at yourself as though you've done this, and it has nothing to do with what God has done for you. You look towards the future. You say, and I'm going to do this, and you're leaving God out of your plans. Remember the stock market crash? We've had almost several mini stock market crashes over the past few years. But remember the one that we all remembered being talked about? How there were people who had millions of dollars one day. And if you talk to them, they'd say, my, oh my, I'm retired. I could just eat, drink, and be merry for the rest of my life because I have plenty to live on. And the next day, they were penniless. This is what James is scolding the brethren for. They're saying, I know how everything's set up for now and how it's going to be in the future. And they had nothing to say about God being involved in their life. Existence without God is not true life. Jesus taught Matthew chapter 16, verse 26. For what does it profit to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? I recall a man who his last request was that after he passed away, that his body be put into a convertible limousine, dressed in the most expensive suit that could be bought, a cigar put in his mouth, a silk top hat on his head, a marching band put in front of the car, and he was to be paraded around town. And so that's exactly what they did. Had this big marching band out in front of the car, this big, beautiful, shiny car, the expensive suit, the cigar, the hat, the chauffeur driving this man around. And there was two little boys playing out in the front yard. And as the parade came by, the little boys jumped up to look and see what was going on. And one of them looked at the other and said, "Now, man, that's what I call living." Brethren, that's what the world calls living. You've heard it said, he who has the most toys when he dies wins. Jesus at Luke 12, verse 15, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses." And then he went on to tell a story about a farmer, a man who had a great return on his work that year. He had what we would call a bumper crop. And he had so much return on his effort that he didn't have enough room in his barns, his storage barns. So he tore them down and he built new storage barns. And he was able to sit back and think, man, I've got it made. For the rest of my life, I can just eat, drink, and be merry. I don't have to worry about a thing because, you see, I've worked so hard. I've done so much, and now I can just relax and enjoy. And Jesus says in Luke 12, verse 20, God said, thou fool, tonight you'll surely die. Now I ask you this question. Was God upset with the man because he was wealthy? Is it a sin to be wealthy? Well, if it is, then God allows sin to be used in helping Jesus in John chapter 19 when Joseph of Arimathea took the body of Jesus and buried him in his tomb. Had it not been for a wealthy man, Jesus would not have that tomb to be buried in. So it's not the fact somebody's wealthy that God was not happy with this man. So what was the problem? The man had what I call the Bart Simpson syndrome. Now, I don't watch that cartoon. Never have watched the cartoon. But I have seen commercials for the cartoon. And the reason why I can call this the Bart Simpson syndrome, because of just one little 5 or 10 second piece that I saw where Bart is asked to say the prayer before they eat. And he says, God, we worked for the money to go buy this food, and we did the shopping, and we did the cooking, and we did everything that had to be done for us to be able to have this, so thanks for nothing. Now, that's supposed to be humorous because, you see, it's a cartoon. But that's the attitude of the world. And that's the attitude that's being taught to our children who watch that. But that was the attitude of this rich man. I did it. So I don't have to thank God for what has happened. I don't have to think about sharing with others because I did it. God's left completely out of the picture. And James says to these people, what is your life? Think about what you're doing. What do we learn from this rich man? We learn, just as James said in James 4 and verse 14, that life is uncertain. It's like a vapor. We learn that life does not consist of what we possess. And we learn that life is a time to remember God. Jesus taught Matthew chapter 6, verse 33, but seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And all these things, what things? Material things. Put me first, God said. And all these things, I'll take care of that. But put me first. And there's so many of my brethren that say, yes, I put God first. They claim that God is first, but then they accept jobs that regularly cause them to forsake the assembly. We sing trust and obey, for there's no other way, and then we live as though it all depends upon us. We sing a lie. Seek ye first the kingdom of God in your life. God will take care of all that. What is your life? It's a gift from God. Paul talked in Acts chapter 17, sermon on Mars Hill, verse 25. He taught us that all life comes from God. Life is a creation that cannot be copied. Scientists have been trying to copy it for years. They've been trying to reproduce it. They've been trying to create it, but it cannot be done. Professor George Wald of Harvard once wrote, spontaneous generation, which is the accidental origin of life. He says spontaneous generation is impossible. Yet here we are as a result of it. Did you hear what he said? He contradicted himself. It's impossible, but here we are. It happened. If the theory of spontaneous generation is not accepted, the only alternative is special creation. And this we are unwilling to accept. How sad. Proverbs chapter 26, verse 18. We read, there's more hope for a fool than for a man who's wise in his own eyes. Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 4, we learn that all souls belong to God. because God is the creator and sustainer. And since life is a gift from God, we should live to please him. In Matthew chapter 6, Jesus taught his disciples to pray. And in that prayer, he taught them to pray, "Thy will be done." Jesus taught Matthew chapter 7, verse 21, "Not everyone that says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven." So who gets to go to heaven? But he that doeth the will of my Father who's in heaven. That's why Jesus had previously said, pray and mean it. Thy will be done. The world says, live it up. The world says, party hardy. But I ask you, what do they mean by that? Do they mean, thy will be done, God? In Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man, or the whole duty of man. Paul said in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 21, to live is Christ. Now, what do you think Paul had in mind when he wrote those words? To live is Christ? Do you think in his mind that he was thinking, live it up, party, get as much out of life as you can? You heard the saying, grab all the gusto that you can because you only go around once in life. Oh, you'd have to be my age or older probably to remember that commercial. What are they saying? They're saying that you need to enjoy life. Whatever makes you feel good, do it. Enjoy it. And in their commercial, the way to enjoy life was to drink their beer. Paul said in order to live, we must first die. In Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20, I have been crucified with Christ. What's that, Paul? Paul said, I have died with Christ. I've been crucified with Christ, but nevertheless, I live. Well, how do you do that, Paul? You say you die, but you do live. Yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And the life that I now live in this flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Our life is to be controlled by our faith in Jesus as God's Son. And to live as Christ would have us to live. To have him control us, we've got to have the mind of Christ, 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 16, which means our thoughts, our actions, and our words are regulated by what we believe Jesus would say or do. Now, brethren, you've probably seen the little bracelets and hats that say WWJD. What would Jesus do? Well, I would submit to you that if you don't have the mind of Christ so that you can think the way Christ would think, you have no idea what Jesus would do. Just to ask the question, what would Jesus do? I've asked that to some of my brethren, and they said, I don't know. Why don't we know the answers in the book? Because we don't have the mind of Christ. In Philippians chapter 4, verse 8, Paul wrote, finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue and if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Now, Proverbs 23 and verse 7 says, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. My question is, what are we putting into our heart, into our mind? Paul said, meditate on the pure, the good, the holy. Computer workers have a saying, garbage in, garbage out. You know what that means? You can only get out of a computer what you've put into it. And God says, if you put garbage into your heart, that's what's going to come out of your heart. And when we sit here and we say, well, you know, this information is not fit for children, but, you know, it says mature audiences, and I'm mature. And so I'm so mature that I can sit and I can allow garbage to come into my mind because I fit the category of mature audiences. I'm 17 and older. Since where do you find in God's Word that it says when you get to be a certain age that you're mature enough to expose yourself to sin? Whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Now, when we sit there, and we've heard some good lessons already that have touched on this type of thing, but it has to be reemphasized because it's something that I see in the church as being a continual battle that for some reason our brethren still haven't gotten. And that is, we'd sit here and say, is it all right to say cuss words? Well, no, a Christian should never let corrupt communication or filthy words come out of their mouth. That's wrong. Would you allow somebody to come into your house and to speak like that in front of your children? No, I wouldn't. I'd tell them they need to stop or they need to leave. And then we'll turn our television on and we'll invite those people in to use that language that we just finished saying we would never use and we would never allow anybody in our house to use. But because it's on the television, for some reason, that's different. Well, it's on every channel, Brother Kidwell. Well, I don't know about your TV set. Maybe mine's the only one, you know, mine's only 3 or 4 years old. So, you know, well, no, I take that. Mine's only a couple of years old. My television only a couple of years old. And it's got one of these little boxes that came with it that's got these buttons on it. And when there's words that come on there that aren't fit to listen to, do you know that I can hit the button and it'll go to another station? And if I don't like that one, I can go to another station. Matter of fact, I got a satellite. I've only got about 150 channels that I can change before I decide there's nothing on anything. But you see, if there's nothing on any channel, then I've got one more option that maybe your television doesn't have. It's called an off button. Now, when I was growing up, my dad didn't need the remote control box, but we still had a remote control box. It was called Tim. Go change the channel. My mother sometimes would be in the back of the house and I'd be watching. I love John Wayne movies. As a kid, I loved to watch the old John Wayne westerns and war movies. And every once in a while, even on the black and white ones, there'd be an ugly word come out. And my mother would be in the back of the house and they'd say this word and I would just cringe because the next thing I heard was, turn that filth off! Why would she say that? Because it shocked her to hear it. Brethren, we're not shocked to hear that stuff anymore. We've been desensitized. We pay the money to have it come into our house. We pay the money to stand in line and go see it and hear. We'd never allow somebody to come into our house half naked. We'd never allow anybody to come into our house and go upstairs and use one of our bedrooms for sexual activity. But then we will rent the tape and allow it to happen right there in our living room. I've heard some of my brethren talk about, oh, that was such a good movie. It only had a little bit of cussing in it. It just had a little bit of nudity in it. The mind of Christ, that to live a life that's faithful to God, to have the life. What is your life? It needs to be a life that has the mind of Christ. Let's invite Jesus to the next movie we go to watch. Well, I don't go to the theater. Well, you know, we can't do that. I go down and wait till it's at Blockbuster and have it at that. Well, let's invite Jesus into our home. And when it comes on, we say, Jesus, this is a good movie. Now, there's going to be a little bit of nudity. But, well, you know, I'll let you know when that's coming up because I've already seen it. Pass the popcorn, please, Jesus. Can you see that happening? No, we would be embarrassed. I've talked to teenagers before and said, what would happen if the Lord were coming over to your room to go to your house to go in your bedroom? And I know that many of them would be running in there. They know the Lord's coming in here. And they'd start ripping down posters off the wall and hiding CDs. Brother, your clock's fast. The mind of Christ. What is your life? Is a journey to our home. What's a stranger? What's the definition of stranger? That means somebody that's out of place. They don't belong. What's the definition of a sojourner or a pilgrim? That's somebody that's not at home, that's traveling. Well, the Bible tells us in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 13 that Christians are strangers and pilgrims. Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11 that we are sojourners and pilgrims. Now, why would we be called that by God? It goes along with what we read in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 9 and 10, and talk about Abraham. Abraham lived in the land of promise. He lived in the land that God had promised him, the promised land, but he cast his eyes toward the city whose builder and maker is God. You see, even though he was in the physical land of promise, he knew he was still just traveling, just passing through, headed towards heaven. Brethren, what is your life? It's supposed to be a journey. It is a journey. It's supposed to be a journey to heaven. But the only way it can be a journey to heaven will be if this place is not considered your home to you, and you're living your life the best that you can to please God so that you can one day be prepared to meet the Father. In Matthew chapter 25, Jesus told a parable of 10 virgins. 5 were called wise and 5 were called foolish. They were waiting on the bridegroom to come for the feast. And during the night, 5 of them found out that they're running out of oil. Their lamps were going out. They had only brought enough oil to fill their lamps up. 5 others had brought extra. But the bridegroom had not come yet. They woke him up and said, please give us some of your oil. We can't do that. If we give you some of our oil, we may not have enough. And so they had to leave. And while they're gone, the bridegroom comes. The 5 wives, they go with the bridegroom. They go into the feast. The door is shut. The 5 foolish show up at the door. They're knocking on the door. Here we are. Let us in. The bridegroom looks out and he says, I don't know who you are. Now, what's he trying to tell us? He's saying for us to be prepared. But how? What's this got to do? Be prepared. Oil. Some have oil, some don't. Give us some of your oil. No, we can't. Brethren, you can't borrow righteousness from somebody else. There are going to be some people saying, Lord, if you had just come earlier, I was prepared. Or Lord, I was planning on being prepared later. But Lord, why do you got to come now? And we look at each other, you know, can I borrow something? You can't borrow righteousness. You got to be prepared. There will be no second chances, brethren. There will be no do-overs. This is not a practice run. There will be no 1,000-year reign. There will be no penance in purgatory. There will be no reincarnation. There will be no baptism for the dead. Once this life is over, it's the judgment. And we do not, brethren, know how much time that we have. Length of time is uncertain. James compared it to a vapor. We've all sat and watched a pot of water boil and steam come up. And as we see it come up, it can be really so thick that if you put your hand on the other side, you can't even see your hand because the steam is so thick. But within just a few feet, it's clear because it's gone. James says that's how our life is. Psalm chapter 144, verse 4, life is compared to a breath and a passing shadow. Job 9, verses 25 and 26, life moves faster than a runner and quicker than an eagle. 2 Samuel 14:14, life is like water spilled on the ground. I have not met anybody yet, regardless of how long they've been blessed to live. I have not met anybody that has ever said, Man, it seems like I've been on this earth a long time. I've not met anybody yet that said, it just seems like I've been here forever. Now, I've had some people say it seemed like I've been married forever, but I've never had anybody say that it seemed like they've been on this earth forever. Everybody I've ever talked to, when they start reminiscing, say, it seems like yesterday. When that grandparent's holding their child, their grandchild, they're saying, it seems like yesterday this was my baby and not my grandbaby. When they see their daughter going down the aisle to be married, it seems like yesterday that was me walking down that aisle, or me standing right down here waiting on my bride. Psalm chapter 90, verse 10. The days of our lives are 70 years, if by reason of strength, 80 years. But no matter, brethren, whether it be 70, 80, or 180, it's still going to seem like a vapor. Life is a gift from God. We must live our life according to His will in order to be found faithful in heaven. We must live our life for God today. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 2, Paul says, behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. What is your life? Thank you for your attention.